Good day and welcome to episode 15 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. This week, we're talking about education and, in particular, school reopenings in the Guelph area. You'll hear from Upper Grand District School Board Superintendent Gary Slater, Martha McNeil, chair of that same board, Mark Berardini, union rep with the Catholic Board, and questions posed by a number of concerned parents. Dustin Brown was our moderator. We're starting off with Mr. Slater, and if this episode seems choppier than my usual stunning editing job, it's because the Zoom meeting had a few interruptions to manage. Here we go.
Okay, thank you, and good morning, everybody. Nice to be here. Nice to be able to talk to folks. Martha and I had a similar kind of Zoom meeting a few weeks ago with another group, and it's always interesting, and it's always interesting to know what the questions are from various stakeholders. So thanks for having us. Martha did a good job of kind of talking about the big picture things, and just sort of I'm going to rewind just a little bit as well to the spring. And talk just a little bit about then, and but more so now, what did the opening of school look like? For us, we back in March, we had to, as you know, shift very quickly to everybody being online, and tens of thousands of devices went out of the board office to students so that they could get online and help to provide internet connectivity for some of them. Where we could, there are some places we couldn't. So that was a massive shift for us, and it kind of kicked everybody into high gear. So I had to smile when someone made the comment this morning about teachers in the microwave. For some of our teachers, that was a huge shift too. And so the fact that you folks are on a Zoom meeting, you could probably teach in the 21st century now too. So don't even worry about that. And I would suggest you go to the college if you can. So when the summer rolled around and students were back home, the boards were all directed to come up with three different models for possible return. And we didn't know till early August what that would look like. So we either had to be prepared for a fully online return, a fully in-school return, or a hybrid model, which they called adaptive, and part online and part in school. And when August came, different boards were given different direction. And I think our thinking was at the beginning of the summer that all boards would have been the same, but that wasn't the case. And so when August came, Upper Grand and our local Wellington Catholic Board as well were ordered to have students come in full time. So it was not the hybrid model or the fully remote model. And in our secondary schools, it was the same thing. In other boards, the secondary schools, some of them did go with that hybrid model. So that was the difference. All elementary schools in the province were full open, and some secondary models were hybrid and some were full in. So we developed our plans around that, and there would be sort of new updates on a regular basis from the ministry about what those plans needed to look like. And then, as you will probably know, there were several reports from Sick Kids, and then a Sick Kids second report with other hospital contribution to it, London and CHEO in Ottawa and those kinds of things. And so those reports were given, and then lots of information from the Ministry of Health. So our job at the board level was to take all that information and help make a plan to operationalize both our board offices and more, the bigger job was for schools. And so we started off by putting out, the first document that went out was a parent guide. So it went on the website once we knew what our model was going to be, kind of outlining what we were going to start the school year with. And then from that developed staff guides, we developed guidance documents for our schools so they could, so we would sort of distill all that information into how to operationalize that in your school. What should recess look like? What should entry and exit in the morning look like? What do cafeterias and high schools look like? So all those kinds of questions about running schools. And then we turned it over to the schools sort of mid-August, and then they created plans for their schools. and communicate it out to their community. So that's sort of that how that flow of information happened. And it sort of got to the point where we thought, you know what, we can plan all we want, but we actually just need the kids in the school to see how the plans play out. And then we'll be able to tweak them as we go. And that's certainly what happened. Just before school started, trustees made the decision to extend the ministry requirement for masking from grade 4 and up all the way down to junior kindergarten. And a number of boards have done that. And so that was just something that was additional that played into it. So again, it was, let's see how that goes, because we weren't sure. We heard lots of messages that said that's a great decision. And there were others that said young kids, 3-4-year-olds, just won't be able to handle that for a day. So when we opened, I would say that, just to rewind again a little bit, we did start off our elementary and our secondary schools with a staggered entry. So we didn't bring everybody in on the first day. They came in elementary, half the students were in for a couple of days, and then the other half were in. And that allowed us to work with smaller groups of students to start establishing those routines around the hand hygiene, physical distancing. What does that look like when you're walking down the hall? What does that look like in the classroom? And all those pieces that they had to learn at the startup of the year, which would be different than normal. That, of course, in addition to all the regular startup things that have to be reviewed with students at the beginning of the year. So it allowed us a little bit of time to build that into the system. So in light of all of that, our startup overall in the system in the first couple of weeks of September was quite calm. The issue around the masks really turned into a non-issue. Students took to them very easily, and partly I think because they had been wearing them to be out and about throughout the summer and other times. So there, it wasn't like it was brand new to them, but even our young ones in kindergarten, there were very few issues that came up, and people in schools were able to work through the ones that did. So for the most part, I would say that was really successful. And overall, students were just happy to be back to school and seeing their friends. And despite the restrictions around some of that, for sure, there was a real positivity around that. Was there anxiety? Yeah, no question there was. There would be some students who were more anxious than others. We had some parents who were more anxious than others. And same with staff. We had some staff who were just gung-ho, ready to go. And others were more reticent, as you said. You know, so lots of questions, I think, and just uncertainty about what was this all going to look like when we finally got to school. So a couple things that have happened since the beginning of school then. The ministry has put in some reporting processes. So every day, school administrators and the office staff go into a website and they put in information around, so far, it's been minimal. It's around the number of confirmed COVID cases in the school, whether it's staff, students, and the number of closed classrooms by public health and that kind of pandemic information. And at the school board level, we also have a daily meeting with the ministry, and it's at 9 a.m. in the morning, and I'm the COVID lead for the board, so that's me. And so I will sort of have to tuck out at just before 9 o'clock this morning, and so I can connect with our ministry person. And so that's been put in place in terms of reporting and keeping the community informed, because when we do have positive cases, they do go on our board website, and there's information on school websites, as well as the ministry has a complete listing of confirmed COVID cases in schools. So that confirmation is a public health confirmation. They let us know when we have a confirmed case. We can't rely on other sources. So that is all in place. And I will let you know that we have had three schools with a confirmed COVID case in our board. The first one was last Friday. And in terms of process, what I can just thought I would let you know what that might look like a little bit. We have initial contact comes to me and to the school principal. I get informed from public health, the school principal through the assigned nurse for the school. So public health has nurses assigned to each of our schools. they contact the principal, and then a whole series of things happen. So the school provides a wealth of information to the public health nurses, and they provide student names and contacts for affected classes, staff contact. They provide seating plans for classrooms if necessary, a seating plan for the school bus if the child or staff member is a bus connection. There's connections to our before and after school programs and our childcare programs. So all that information is gathered and given to public health. And then they do their contact tracing. So they will determine when the exposure period was, who was in contact, and then make a decision based on that information, who they're going to contact and whether that person needs to now isolate or and for how long, and then also make a decision about whether a class needs to close and whether ultimately whether there's an outbreak in a school, and if that outbreak is great enough, whether a school would need to close. So that's sort of how that process works. So we've now worked through that three times, and it's each time there's always something new, and we tweak our processes a little bit because it's an ongoing learning thing. We have found out, oh, well, we didn't think that might happen. So now what are we going to do next time? So it's been quite interesting. It's a fair bit of work for our schools, and it is a little bit stressful. I'll be quite honest with you, for our staff and communities as well, because all of a sudden they don't know. And again, raises lots of questions about, do I need to go get tested? How much risk am I at? How much risk are my children at? Is it going to come home? So lots of those questions get generated. And so we do our best to communicate what that process looks like. We have standard procedure letters that go home immediately to the community. And it just tells exactly what public health is going to be doing and that they'll be contacted if there are any issues. So we work through that very closely with public health. And so far, the communication has been excellent. It's been really great in terms of how does that work. So that is roughly what that looks like in terms of a process. And happy to stop there. If there are questions, I can talk a little bit more about some of the other aspects that are happening within the board.
Looks like Mark just offered a view from the trenches. So let's see about it.
Hi, everyone. I could hardly forgive myself if I would have missed this. Thanks, Phil and James and Dustin, for getting this together. You will not hear a union president often say how hard that the board, superintendents, and everybody worked over the summer. It was absolute crazy. They and as well as myself, there was no summer break. And with Ford, and I'll get more political, frankly, every 4 days or 3.5 days or maybe even five, it was Monty Python now for something completely different. And you heard Gary refer to that and Martha referred to that. So we got to July 31st in Upper Grand and Wellington. We basically all prepared for some kind of hybrid model. And then it was, oh, we're not in the GTA. And bang, we were told everybody's coming back. So that just threw all the administrative types up in the air. That was a massive blow to our planning that had started way back in May, June, and really, really got underway in July. And then there was wait, you know, and we'll get back to you, and weeks went by, and then you'd get back to, you know, something you brought up. Ford kept saying how he was talking all the time to people and Leche and everything. But, you know, they can listen to someone talk, but if there's no back and forth conversation, and it's still going on, and that resulted in all four OTF unions putting in the Ministry of Labor complaint. We're doing the best we can, but there's no teacher, and I'm sure Phil had this as well, that wasn't worried about what school was going to look like. And in the spring, I always said, well, at least the kids are safe. You know, when you looked at what happened in the senior citizens care homes, and we went, at least our kids are safe. And now all of a sudden, you know, we were, oh my God, we're going to be back. And, you know, we're on the verge right now. Upper Grand's got three schools affected. We've got two. I do know it took 5 days for one of the schools to actually show up on the provincial school website for an outbreak. You know, so that's concerning. We knew there were cases in our area, and it's not coming up on public health that day. And you're waiting to see, well, you know, there's a couple cases in Guelph today. Is that the day that they finally got the ones from the school? And if we know of five or six cases in our schools, and we're not seeing that, what's the delay? And how long is it going? And what's the false sense of security? And every teacher becomes an analyst, and then, their own Anthony Fauci, and starts going, oh no, and they start working the numbers. And that's kind of normal for everybody in our world right now. But we know that we have to stand in line to get into a liquor store with only 10 people, and we can walk right in. And, you know, they talk cohorts. Well, they must mean the Roman centurion numbers and 600 people. Because that's what a cohort means to a teacher. The first thing you have to understand, staff does not count as a physical person contact when we do the schools. So you could be working at two or three schools and you're not counted as a spreader. And one third of the teachers are above the age of 45 probably right now, or 40. And you know, we're more at risk. So you want to hear about why OTs that retired are not coming back. Well, they're all going, well, I'm at risk, and my husband or my wife or my partner or my family, someone else is even older and they're at risk. So they are, you know, not coming into, you know, they've taken leaves of absences. The OT shortages today, I work with my board better than most. Our attendance supply caller, she emails me at 6:30 every morning and says short. I've got my short list of everybody I know that's part-time and everybody that's looking, and they get an automatic email from me, and we truly shake the bushes, but we just don't have the bodies anymore. And this isn't, we were in bad shape for shortages in the last 2.5 years, and now it's even worse. The grads don't match up to the need right now, and the College of Teachers and the ministry changed it to a 2-year program. We can't sustain that. It's not working. Plus, when the government attacks you every so many years, people are going, you know what, it's easier to do something else. So there's a massive shortage in what's in our profession right now. The one school we had affected had a classroom, and the one classroom that gets sick is the one with the French teacher who works at the other school. So you can see how you can get a spread really quickly. And even the central staff, different school boards have different models, and some of them are still going school to school because we don't count. So that, and there's grave inconsistencies across the province. Upper Grand and Wellington have done a fairly good job at the best model possible. We're a little different than Upper Grand because we've went the full kind of semester style summer school. So week one is one day, one course all week. And then week two, you get your second course. So where they're flipping who's in school and who's out of school, we have the same kids every week in school. And then the next week, they start the second course. And we'll do that through what they're calling a quad semester. So otherwise, we're pretty close. But we've actually cut down the number of people in the schools every day. And, you know, maybe that'll be a little safer because you won't have someone sick in two classes all the time. You'll have a week worth. So, and that's also, I don't know, unfortunately, I was never the math genius that I should have been. And I had to take summer school and math to up my grades sometimes. And those are brutal courses for students. And as a person who's taught summer school, it's hard to keep kids engaged for, 9 o'clock till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's a hard, hard time. And now add into it, we have to be in our own, what they call a cohort, but our own classroom as much as possible. It's not that the libraries are closed. It's like we can't just go into the library room because another class can't go in there after. We have to keep our kids separate. Thankful to Upper Grand and Mike, and he's still on, I think. They jumped ahead at first, and they went to lowering masks down to the primary students, and thank God they did, because then we followed suit, although FDK we didn't, which if you heard Gary, he's absolutely right. Our FDK classes can have 28 kids. well, there's two educators, but now there's an extra two bodies at least breathing the same air, and half the kids might not have masks. And it's really up to the parents buying in. And in some cases, it's great. You walk into an FDK room and every parent sent their kids with nice decorated masks, and everybody's more safe than they would be. But there are a few exceptions where it just takes a handful of parents that don't believe in it. And just like everywhere else in society, you end up with a whole class of 27 kids and one's got a mask on. So that's frightening. And then it's frightening for the planning time teacher who walks in. So now we talked about two adults in the room. Well, here comes a third for 50 minutes every day. And then they're going to another one and another one and up to five other classes. So you can see how, you know, when we don't count as adults, the cohorts, you know, the super spreader and everything else is smoke and mirrors by Ford. Boards, so the trustees are doing the best they can, and they're we're pitching in. Everybody's got to roll up the sleeves. We do that every day. We do that when we don't have computers at work and everything else that comes rolling out. That's normal. But there's nothing normal about this time. I am so worried. I'm on the phone to, you know, dozens of teachers who are quarantined right now, and I only have, you know, about 600 part-time, full-time classroom teachers, and I'm swamped. And so, you know, if that's happening here, and we've been lucky, I don't know how Waterloo or Toronto or Ottawa and the hotspots are going to survive. And, you know, it is a very real problem. What do? You get the ministry to do their job, and they turn that two-year teacher's college back to 1 year, and it's not about money grab and an extra $7,000 of going to university so they can fill their pockets. And you turn around and say, okay, you graduated in May, we're going to buddy you up in a school for May and June for additional work, which is what they wanted out of is classroom work, and attach them to schools and let them learn from your senior people and let them energize that youthful energy back into the profession. And that's part of that first year. We can do it in 1 year. We can do it at a reasonable cost, and we can get back and getting people trained to be the one of the best teaching areas in the world, not just Canada, in the world. And you want to talk numbers? So virtual schools, I've got a 39 and a 35. 35 grade sevens with 11 special needs. Talking to one teacher on Hollywood Squares right now. You know, you can be the best teacher in the world. It's going to take 6 weeks before you figure out how to do it. And then even then, it's not going to be perfect. And face-to-face, I've got a 39, a 36, and a 33, and then lots of little 30s at the secondary level. And you put that yardstick down, let's not even go 2 meters. There's 1 meter, they're all over, they're sitting on each other. So that's our reality. The 39, we moved into the library so they could spread out all over. And that's the government. And that's their just, they took the sick kids said 15 days and they, oh yes, we did everything. Well, they didn't do anything. And we know that we can't get our classes down to 15, but if you've got 35 in a pandemic, something needs to be done from the top. The last comment is a parent, you know, their kid's sick, they bring them home. They don't have to prove that they took them for a test or they got them to the doctor. It's the honor system. And there's a lot of privilege here. I have 3 FDK kids right now, grandchildren, that all started JK. But their moms, my lovely daughter-in-laws, are all on mat leave. So we have privilege economically and luck that they're all home. But if you're a working class person who has no daycare, minimum wage, or if you're lucky, minimum wage that got a $2 boost, which most of it got rolled back, you're going to work and your kids are going back to school sick.
Thanks very much, Phil and James and Dustin, for that great introduction. Phil is quite right. I am very passionate about education and the arts and arts education, but education in general, very passionate about that. And so I'm pleased to be here today to talk a little bit about what we're doing. I was asked to speak a little bit about governance. I hope it's exciting for you guys. I don't know. I find it very exciting, but I'm kind of nerdy like that. So bear with me while I explain a little bit about what the trustees have been up to. And then Superintendent Slater is going to talk a little bit more, or probably a lot more than me, about all the actual nuts and bolts of what has been happening as far as school and reopening. So I thank you for your interest in school reopening, and I'm glad you're all here. I appreciate everyone getting up early in the morning to talk about education, because I love doing that too. So during the pandemic, obviously for everybody, it's been an unusual time. It was an unusual time for trustees as well. Much of our usual role was either temporarily suspended due to schools being closed or due to changes from the government. Clearly during the school closures, we weren't doing our regular school visits that we like to do. We go and visit with the principal and the teachers and check out classrooms, or we go for plays and Remembrance Day ceremonies, all the things that we love to do, and see our classrooms and students and teachers. So clearly that wasn't happening during the school closures. Clearly, you know, parents weren't calling us or emailing us about issues, school specific issues, like school site specific issues, because clearly nobody was at the school. And, you know, all the other things that we generally do, which is not to say that we were doing nothing. We were just doing it in a different way. So our meetings, our usual meetings, also took on a different role. We weren't receiving reports about energy use or mental health initiatives. We did a little bit, but all of those usual things that we get, clearly, we weren't doing that. It was basically pandemic and response all the time, which obviously. So in the and it was in different phases too. So in the spring, it obviously was very intensely focused on distance learning and the technology, the massive amount of technology that it took to make that happen. Then as, you know, spring turned into summer, the focus shifted a little bit and the staff were developing plans for the return to school. And we were learning about that, and also return to the workplace for our non-teaching staff. So all the folks here at the board office who were all working from home, some plans for that, for returning to that. And then, you know, of course, as summer turned to fall, we were focused on the actual reopening of schools. So this morning is a great example of adaptation. Trustees also quickly adapted to doing our meetings virtually. We went off on the longest March break ever. There was a bit of a break, and then we got right back to it, and we figured out, well, our amazing IT department figured out how we were going to meet virtually and do all of that stuff. And much like all of you and the rest of the world, we had to figure out how to do all this stuff. We had to relearn how to run formal meetings with motions and voting and delegates, and when it's all remote, things don't translate directly. So we did go through several versions of our what we call the rules, as far as how people can vote and confidentiality and all that kind of stuff. But we seem to have settled on one right now that's working. But you know, I when I was thinking about this last night, our board motto is learn, lead, and inspire together. And I feel like figuring out how to do these meetings was actually a really good way of living that, because it took a team effort to figure out what to do. So then as board chair, I participated in weekly teleconferences with the Minister of Education and the board chairs from across the province. This was an opportunity for chairs to hear updates directly from the minister, as well as being able to ask him questions. And at times, the minister also looked to this group for guidance and suggestions on various topics, which is not to say we were a part of, you know, any of the command tables or any of that kind of stuff, but they did at least ask us once in a while our opinion. And then just before school started, the board chairs were also invited to participate in a teleconference with the premier as well as the minister. We received brief updates, and also that was when they introduced Dr. Dirk Heyer, who is leading the response for the province. And then continuing in our role as advocates for public education and our educational community, trustees voted on sending some letters to the minister. In the spring, I wrote on behalf of the board regarding our opinion on the timing of the reopening of schools. And then I guess it's October now. So in September, I wrote on behalf of the board to request additional funding over and above our budgeted amount, and also what we've been allowed to access in our reserves. This funding will enable us to hire more teachers for the purpose of reducing class sizes, as well as enable us to hire bus monitors so that drivers can focus on driving safely. And so students will be assisted on the bus to stay in their seats to maintain distancing and to wear their masks properly for the entire ride. I have to edit that though and say, in the time since we sent that letter, it has become clear that there's a serious teacher and bus driver shortage in the province, so we are unsure as to whether this additional funding will be granted. And then in addition to the advocacy work I just mentioned, as the reopening of school approached, trustees were able to return to some of their traditional roles. We answered many, many, many phone calls and emails from parents regarding the return to school, and we worked very hard to get answers for the parents or to direct them to the right staff person to help them out. And at our September 1st board meeting, we were able to return to having our meetings in the boardroom, sort of. It is a hybrid of in-person and virtual, as it likely will be for a very long time. And we're actually quite pleased to have been able to develop this method and work out how to make virtual meetings happen, because, you know, for one thing, it will allow greater ease of attending meetings for our members who have long distances to travel, which can be quite hazardous in the winter. And then another good thing that has come from this has been the use of live stream for broadcasting our meetings. Previously, we were lucky if we had one or two people watching our meetings in person, sometimes nobody, which is fine, but now we regularly have significant numbers of people watching, and we appreciate this, that the community has the ability to be better informed about our work. So getting there with the virtual meetings took a bit of work, but I think in the end we really appreciate what it gave us. And so I think that's really, in a nutshell, what we've been up to. So thank you for your interest and taking the time to learn about what we do.
With regard to autism, it used to be one out of every 100,000 students would be autistic 20 years ago. Now apparently it's one out of 42. But my question is more general than that. What exactly is being done to address the needs of children with disabilities with special needs?
So there are three parts to that. The first one was around special ed resources. So in school, maybe I'll talk a little bit. I had mentioned a little bit about our online school. And so we do have nearly 4,000 elementary students have parents elected not to come to our brick and mortar schools. So they are in our remote school. It's an elementary remote school. It has four administrators, some office staff to manage it, but it's all virtual. And so that's different than, in terms of that special education question, than our brick and mortar schools. In our brick and mortar schools, we have resource teachers. They are able to go into classrooms. They are able to support that way, and EAs. in our virtual school. We also have resources that can connect with those students that have special education needs. And we do have a couple of EAs even attached to that school to provide that kind of support for those students. So those are like the academic supports that are provided. And where we have certain other specialized equipment, not necessarily just for autism, say, but in terms of assistive devices, in terms of vision and hearing to go along with the other technology that's provided, we provide that as well, so that there's just accommodations for some of those disabilities as well. So students who are on an individual education plan, so that would be a special education plan specific to their learning, those plans are still in place, and schools are adapting them for that online learning platform so that they can best meet their needs where they're at. So it for sure is a different kind of challenge, but the overall processes are still the same.
Okay, thanks. We're going to move on to other questions from other folks now. One was going back to the topic of students moving to opt into online classes. What are the reasons that people are citing for doing that? If you're aware, is it due to parents' anxieties? Is it due to students having being immunocompromised? What's kind of the general feedback that we're getting from that subset of people moving to online?
I would say that it's a combination of things. For sure, it is some students who themselves might be immunocompromised, and it may also be connected to family members who they're living with. So it may be a parent, or it may be a sibling, or even a grandparent that's in the home, and so they want to restrict that. And the other one was just uncertainty. I think how this would look and safety concerns, for sure parents have those concerns, would be another reason that parents would choose that remote school option. We haven't surveyed them and asked individually, but those are the two main reasons that when we do talk to people and when they request, to have made a switch, we had some opportunity and time to do that in the past, sort of mid-August to into early September. Those were the reasons that they were saying that they wanted to go to that remote school. Interestingly enough, at this time, we also have parents in the remote school who are wanting to come back to regular brick and mortar school. So there is a combination of both.
Sure. And another related question that we got from Ron East was, are we considering this to be an alternative, an interim educational model or way of doing education? Or is there any thought that this could become a new normal in terms of how things are approached?
Oh, that's a really good question. And we have started sort of just having general conversations about that at the school board as well, as whether this is something that's temporary or whether going forward, if there is an end to this and what it looks like, whether this would be an option that we would continue to explore. There'd be lots of things to work out around that. But it does present an interesting question that, for sure, for some families, this is a model that really works well. And so we are going to take a look at that, but we have absolutely not come to any decisions on that yet.
Yeah, that I think will be an interesting one to see unfold, and I'm sure is dependent on how long kind of the pandemic holds society in this stasis. Stasis is the wrong word because things are changing every day. But there it is. Another question was around the classification of an outbreak at a school. How many students need to have confirmed positive cases before it's called an outbreak? And is that dependent on the size of the school? Is it percentage-based or absolute numbers?
No, it's an absolute number. And interestingly enough, the number is 2. And so we do have, if you look at our current stats on our board website, we have 3 schools, 1 confirmed case in each school, but in one of the schools, there's a I guess I'll use the word presumptive confirmed case. It hasn't been totally confirmed case yet, but we're expecting it at any time. Public health has gone ahead and said that's an outbreak. That meets their definition for an outbreak. So the one school has that. The important thing to know about that is that it doesn't mean the school is now shut down. It is a definition of that there is two, more than one, basically. There's two in the school. And in that situation, three classrooms have been closed because of all of the contacts that were made in that exposure period time. So that is what they're using as their definition.
So next question. Well, actually, we have a follow-up question to something that you just said, which was that it's a model that works well for some parents. Maybe just if you can clarify how it works well for some parents, because the commenter here is saying, are you talking about learning achievements? And is wondering, isn't it maybe premature to say that it's positive in terms of learning achievements?
Yeah, no, I would be a reference to the ability of some families to have a child at home online. The new requirements that came out in the summer from the ministry for grades 1 to 8, for example, and in high school to be 225 minutes of face-to-face time online with a teacher, excuse me, out of the 300 minutes of a school day. And so for some families, that just works functionally. In terms of that academic piece, we'll see sort of how that plays itself out. It's very different than the spring when there were no strict guidelines around time and the focus was really on math, language, and in some cases, science, social studies. And so it's a very different looking feel to the school day. It's far more structured online now. So there are very specific times when, for example, the French teacher will be coming into that online classroom and doing that French instruction. And assessment will absolutely look a little different online. So the question statement around it works for some families is around that structural piece and their family. I think a lot of it's tied to COVID. And as you mentioned earlier, the immunocompromised piece, that's a really helpful thing to keep for some. I've absolutely heard it keeps families together because either a parent or grandparent would have to move out in order for the child to go to school and back every day because of just of that exposure worry. So it's really that structural piece, not the academic piece.
Okay, if you'll just give me a moment, I'm scrolling through the chat here, just making sure there are no follow-ups to that. I think looks like we're good to move on. One of our guests was asking about the bus driver shortage and how that might be approached. Let me just scroll back up to that if I can find it. I think it was Susan who was asking that, right?
Yeah, I can see the question from Susan. It's talking about bus drivers and how to overcome the shortage. So it's interesting. It's a provincial level problem. And in our area right now, we don't have a shortage. So we're good right now in terms of our drivers there's obviously supply drivers. So if, you know, just in a regular course of a regular school year, a driver may be ill or unable to work and there's supply drivers. So we're okay with that right now. Our worry, of course, would be down the road if there was an increased absenteeism with the drivers, that would possibly create issues. In some boards, boards are running buses every other day instead of every day in order to accommodate the shortage. So it's difficult. Our transportation, and this happened quite a number of years ago, it used to be that for example, the Upper Grand District School Board had its own transportation department. We no longer do. There's a consortium that is external to us that runs the transportation.
Question about buses.
For all the boards in our area. So they are responsible for contracting and hiring the bus companies who then hire the drivers. So it is a complex problem, and it's something that fortunately right now it's not on our plate.
Superintendent Slater, you said that the driver shortage isn't as much of an issue for us in this area. How about teachers? I've heard some chatter about people looking for teachers to get back in the game or to apply for positions. What's going on there?
So for sure, again, teachers across the province are in high demand, and particularly will come to no surprise to folks that French teachers are even more scarce to find. And so it's certainly an issue. Again, do we have enough staff? Yes, we do. We have enough staff for our classrooms. We also have enough for our regular supply lists. But again, depending on the trajectory of COVID and what happens, again, our thinking around that is looking down the road. If we have a lot of absenteeism, what does that then look like? And so schools do have sort of contingency plans around pulling people in, as well as redistributing people within the building for a day or two or whatever that might take. And then, if we take that to the nth degree of problem and we just can't cover, then a decision may need to be made that the school might need to close for safety reasons until we can make sure we have enough staff. So we certainly are nowhere near that yet, but certainly it's something that's on our radar and we're constantly looking and hiring.
Superintendent Slater, you said that the driver shortage isn't as much of an issue for us in this area. How about teachers? I've heard some chatter about, people looking for teachers to get back in the game or to apply for positions. What's going on there?
So, for sure, again, teachers across the province are in high demand, and particularly will come to no surprise to folks that French teachers are even more scarce to find. And so, It's certainly an issue. Again, do we have enough staff? Yes, we do. We have enough staff for our classrooms. We also have enough for our regular supply lists. But again, depending on the trajectory of COVID and what happens, again, our thinking around that is looking down the road. If we have a lot of absenteeism, what does that then look like? And so schools do have sort of contingency plans around pulling people in, as well as redistributing people within the building for a day or two or whatever that might take. And then, if we take that to the nth degree of problem and we just can't cover, then a decision may need to be made that the school might need to close for safety reasons until we can make sure we have enough staff. So we certainly are nowhere near that yet. But certainly it's something that's on our radar and we're constantly looking and hiring.
So I'm going to ask kind of shift gears a little bit to maybe structural issues in the schools. Were there any HVAC retrofits or renovations needed in order to facilitate proper airflow in any of the classrooms? And that's going to tie into it. Another question about class sizes, but maybe let's just start with the HVAC question.
Yeah, for sure, ventilation is not my area of expertise. We do have a capital and operations department, which would certainly be able to provide better information on that. We did not, given there was funding from the ministry for ventilation, a certain amount was given to each school board in August. So major retrofits in terms of turning over a whole system, we're not done. They're just, it was in terms of timing, that wasn't possible. And so we have started the year off with a number of things. One priority was just quite honestly from public health, it was simply keeping windows open. And so encouraging that whenever possible to bring fresh air into the classrooms. We do have some classrooms which would not have an exterior window on them. They're interior in the building. And so we've provided air purifiers, portable units for each one of those classrooms, as well as schools were given a couple more to use in certain spaces in their buildings where they knew that that would be possibly have a challenge or need some extra ventilation that could happen. But we do have those departments, Operation Capital, looking at things like ensuring that all the filters are up to date and all those pieces that they can do quickly are being looked at.
Okay. So I have a comment here from one of our guests saying, just wanted to let you know, my student is really enjoying this week in her Indigenous Issues class, but is already dreading next week when it is going to function all day. Our family is able to spend an hour after supper helping with math homework, but I really worry about students without the level of support that we can offer. Not sure if you want to speak to that, just kind of disparity between different family situations or home situations in terms of how this might be playing out. I don't know if you've heard anything to that effect or...
It's a little, it's interesting because it's a little different from the spring. This fall, our remote schools offer that face-to-face learning that's happening. They also offer an option to more similar to the spring where work can be provided and not attend those face-to-face classes with the teacher. And that provides some flexibility for some families whose schedules don't meet that during the daytime. They can't schedule 10 a.m. for French and plan their days like that. So we do offer that as a separate option so that they can tailor the work around what works for them. And certainly the in-school option is there as well. So there's a number of ways of addressing it. But there are also probably situations out there that are a bit unusual. And we do just encourage parents to talk to either the brick and mortar school principal or the remote school principals to work out those situations. It's not easy for sure in some situations.
So Lisa's talking about a 300-hour requirement for courses and is concerned that the curriculum is being delivered in a heavy way and that this might prevent students. Particularly, Lisa's worried about university-bound students and that maybe being a factor that inhibits their academic success and therefore, you know, future implications for those students. So I'll pass that to you for an answer, Gary, if you like.
Sure. Yeah, and no question. Our model in secondary, which is what you're describing, is more like it's almost like taking a summer school course because it's one course, it's very intensive for a number of weeks, and it's one course only per day. And part of the reason that is the way we started the year was there are requirements around, this doesn't answer the concern about university, it is there for sure, but there are requirements around the number of contacts a student can have while they're at school. So in elementary, the ministry said no more than 50 direct or indirect contacts between other students in the school. In secondary, it was 100. So in order to meet that requirement and try and manage those contacts to keep those cohorts small, this is the model that worked best to start the year and to deliver courses in this manner. So cut the semesters in half. So we now have four semesters, so calling it a quadmester, and in 9 or 10 weeks, a student will take two courses and get 2 credits. So it does intensify the amount of curriculum that has to get covered. And I certainly sympathize if it's a subject that doesn't come as easy to a student, they might struggle with it a bit more. It does require that real strong focus and commitment, which sounds like your daughter has, which is great, in order to try and keep on top of it, because it will move fairly quickly. And you know, when we sort of were working on this model, we thought it's really going to be important that kids are at school, because they will, if let's say, for example, like we do have situations in regular times when a student would say travel and miss a week of school. If you were to miss a week of school now, that's a lot of that coursework that would be missed. So the dynamic is certainly very different in that sense. It is more compact and intense over a shorter period. And again, it will pose different challenges for different students and families.
Well, I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about class sizes at all. So the the real basic question there is, how big is too big in our local context here?
So in for us, and this unfortunately may need to be my last question, I really apologize. I need to slide out in a couple minutes. In our secondary schools, I'll start there first. We have essentially half classes coming right now in this first quadmaster. That's the model we've set up to sort of ease ourselves back to school. And so half of the class comes in the morning is with the teacher, half is in the afternoon. So those class sizes are sort of managed in that way. In elementary schools, it's a little bit different. And our largest classes tend to be, in regular times, kindergarten and grades 4 to 8. Primary is relatively capped at around 20 to 23. Kindergartens can go to 29, but there's two educators in there with the ECE and the teacher. And then 4 to 8 has a different average over the board. So what we've done is we've created extra spaces for those kindergartens. To one educator will take part of the class for the day, the other will take the other part, and they will swap between them. And so we've created some distancing that way in the building. In our intermediate classes, we've added extra long-term occasional teachers to reduce numbers. So you will see numbers that vary. And you know, how much is too much? What we can staff the way we have. So we've put as much staff into the building as, you know, as we're able to. And within that, then work within the parameters. So if, you know, our goal and in, you know, working with public health and the ministry, would be great if it was 2 meters between every student.
Ran out of time again, that's all. Thanks as always to our guests and to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Alt, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for any support you can lend, and as always, for listening.